were you 1 year ago tomorrow, August 14th? I can't remember. Let me try to jog your memory a little bit. Would it jog your memory if I told you that 1 year ago, parts of the East Coast, the Midwest, and Canada were taking part unwillingly, of course, in the largest blackout in North American history? Over 50 million people lost power. 1 million people in Cleveland had no water. And according to the Department of Energy, it all cost us between $4 billion and $6 billion. In the aftermath, politicians called for hearings. Power companies pointed fingers. And engineers set about trying to figure out just what happened and whether we could prevent it from happening again. Well, a year later, they've sorted it out. And we're going to start off the hour by talking about the conclusions some of those engineers have come to, including one idea that blackouts like that are inevitable, mathematically at least. So if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guest. Peter Fairley is a science writer who covers energy and the environment. He's a contributing writer to Technology Review, a contributing editor to the IEEE Spectrum magazine. He wrote the August cover story on the power grid, and he joins us by phone from British Columbia. Welcome to Science Friday.
Nice to be here, Ira.
Thank you. Let's first talk about what happened last year. 60 million people lost power. Did they ever really figure out the sequence of events?
They did. I think they did quite an extensive job of determining exactly what went wrong that day. It was a team struck by the U.S. Department of Energy and by the Government of Canada, which Canada was also affected by the blackout. Mm-hmm. And they basically pinned it down to a series of events in Ohio. You have a power plant that's pushed a little too hard. It goes out of service. Power is rerouted over other power lines from other power plants to serve customers. Those power lines then short out. When they've got more power running through them, they get hotter, they sag, they hit a tree, they short out, they go out of service. So you have this cascade of events starting mm-hmm. to happen. At the same time that you've got these physical changes on the power lines, you have computer malfunctions at the utility in Ohio and also the sort of system regulator in the Midwest, and they can't see what's happening. So things mm-hmm. are really allowed to spiral out of control.
But the systems are self-preserving. They go offline to preserve their infrastructure, right?
That's right. They go offline to ensure that, for example, in the case of a power line, if there's too much power flowing through it, it can melt down. So it's designed to trip off. There's essentially a large fuse that shuts that line off. And the system is supposed to be able to withstand one or two large components, a line or a power station, turning itself off. Mm-hmm. What happened last August was that you had multiple events happening and not being recognized by the operators, and it was simply it was too much for any particular component to handle, so you get this mm-hmm. cascading effect, like a domino effect.
Yet there was at least one city, what was it, in Canada, that preserved itself and stayed on?
Quebec, mm-hmm. Which is part of the Eastern electrical system, stayed online, and it did that because while Ontario and the states in the along the eastern seaboard in the Midwest are all connected to each other with AC power lines, the Quebec lines connect to the rest of the East Coast with DC power lines. There are actually electronic sort of mediators between the systems, and they act as sort of a buffer and protected mm. Quebec.
So it couldn't jump over the AC-DC connection there.
That's right, and using more of that sort of electronics in the system is one of the long-term solutions that's available for stopping blackouts, but it's expensive.
In your story on the cover of the IEEE Spectrum, you talk about a few different group of researchers who say these blackouts are inevitable, that they have different reasons for believing that, but the upshot is the same, that they're bound to happen. Tell us why that is.
Well, this work really began the recognition that blackouts may be inevitable began to take shape in the mid-90s when people started looking at data collected by the industry itself on the frequency of blackouts. And given 10 or years of data, people started to plot it and take a look at, well, what is the frequency of blackouts and what does the shape of the curve look like? And they saw that instead of the frequency of blackouts being pretty randomly distributed, they saw that you got more big blackouts than you'd expect. And it wasn't like the big blackouts stood out as some kind of an outlier, some kind of a freak event. There was a very smooth curve as you looked at bigger blackouts. The curve would sort of bend out and make them more frequent than you'd expect statistically. So people set out trying to figure out why that is. And they recognized that the curve resembled the sort of statistical curve you see with other complex chaotic systems like earthquakes, for example. And that really was the insight that got people started in trying to understand why this might be happening.
So that there's a bit of chaos in the whole infrastructure of the interconnect of all those power?
That's right. And chaos is a bit of a misnomer. Chaos theory, you're not talking about things that are random. You're talking about things that are hard to predict but have some regularity. So there is a sort of underlying structure or regularity to it, even though if you're looking in real time, it seems like events are flying all over the place.
So according to this view, then, you could no more prevent a big power outage than you could stop an earthquake.
That's the idea. That's right. It's a strange idea, given this is an engineered system.
That's
right?
Not and what people want to hear.
Yeah, that's right, and it's not what engineers want to hear. Engineers, the people who build and run the power grids, engineers are can-do people. If there's a problem, they want to find the fix for it. But complex systems, as we've seen with the space shuttle, for example, have a way of defying engineering. It's just very, very hard to pin down every possible combination of failures that could happen.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if I can take a phone call or two. 1-800-989-8255. Mary Beth in Jackson, Ohio. Hi, Mary Beth.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
What we're talking about right now ties in very well with what was on last hour. The way I see it, the electrical companies could really relieve a lot of the problem on the type of days that cause blackouts by looking at the areas that they serve, finding all the roofs that orient south, renting the roofs and installing solar cells, installing net metering in those households, paying the rent by allowing the people to have a reduction in their electrical service proportionate to how much they're producing, then on days when it's super hot and we're likely to get a blackout, there would be more electricity being produced because of the sun. And I think the biggest problem that we have, period, is the total centralization of our electrical grid and the fact that there are other solutions that can help us decentralize and reduce that reliance on huge mega power plants. It also would help with security because you can take out a giant power plant, but you can't take out everybody's roofs if there are millions of roofs that have solar energy on them.
All right, let me get a comment on that. Peter?
I couldn't agree more, and essentially what your caller is talking about is distributed generation, where you're producing more of the power close to where it's being consumed, and as a result you're relying less on the power lines to carry power from one place to another. The electrical utilities recognize, I think, how powerful a solution that is, but it's not one that's going to pay dividends for them necessarily. So they've been reluctant to allow the kind of net metering And that refers to allowing people, for example, who have solar power, to run their meter backwards when they're producing excess power and really make the systems pay for themselves.
I guess if one of the conclusions that your study groups have come up with is that these things are inevitable, like an earthquake is, you then have to find the best way to survive them and
That's
recover.
Right. That's right. And in that sense, now if you have, you know, having your own power generation, solar panels, for example, puts you on the road to really being able to ride through a blackout. But there's one key element that you have to add that most people don't with solar power systems, and that's some kind of a battery backup. You know, if you only have if you have solar power, and the power grid goes out at 7:30 in the evening, your solar power system's not going to do you much good unless you've stored up some energy.
Well, what about until we get to that, if we ever do, to a decentralized system, what about for the big system we have now? Can we create a backup system? Can we, you know, make a computer model that will tell us do this, do that, if things start cascading?
There are models that are commonly used by utilities and system operators, although according to the DOE Canada report on the August blackout, they are not used as much as they should be. But there are models available that give the utility some idea of what the grid is going to do when it's stressed. Improving those models is definitely a good idea. The problem is that the system is simply so complicated, and some of the chaotic behavior is so complex that it's hard to accurately model.
Yeah, but we don't say that when it comes to the weather or the climate. We say, you know, or even nuclear reactions. We say we're going to build a model for it.
And we do, and I mean, we all know how good weather prediction is.
It's getting better.
Nuclear weapons, actually in my story, I quote an industry official saying, hey, if we can model nuclear weapons, we can model the power grid. But, hey, look at the difference in terms of what our society is investing in the two. You know, the U.S. government spends billions of dollars on nuclear weapons modeling. The power industry, in contrast, spends less than pet food manufacturers on R&D. So, you know, they need the resources. They need to bring the resources to bear on the problem if they want to fix it.
All right, so we need a few more blackouts to kick things in the spending direction.
Well, that's one of the ironies of the complex systems theorists. One team that I found particularly fascinating basically looks at blackouts as a constructive force and says it's blackouts that really galvanize our attention and action to improve the power grid. Otherwise, without a blackout, nobody even realizes that the power grid is operating. It sort of fades into the background. We just take it for granted.
Yeah. Well, Peter, we don't want to take you for granted. We want to thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. Peter Farrelly is a science writer who covers energy and the environment. He is a contributing writer to Technology Review and a contributing editor to the IEEE Spectrum, where he wrote this month's cover story on the power grid, a very interesting article. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, switching gears, and talk about the stem cell update. So stay with us.